the next thing we're going to get to is what characterizes these pieces. Because there are a lot of other pieces that are not typical or that don't fit this. And the thing that characterizes all of these pieces is, first of all, they're obviously instrumental, but they're all multi-movement. And that's one of the differences between, say, a march or something of that sort and these. All of these are based on several movements. Now, the interesting thing is there's a standard pattern to all of this that probably, I don't know, 90, maybe 95% of the pieces in any of these genres follow. The big exception will be sonata, because sonatas tend to be a bit more individual. But if you go to a concert and you see that it's going to be a symphony or you see it's going to be a string quartet, just by the name, you already have a lot of information. And there's a lot of things you can expect. First of all, we've talked about who's going to play. Second, you can expect a certain pattern. And here's the pattern. It's essentially, keep in mind, essentially a three-movement pattern. There will be three movements: fast, slow, and then fast. Now, I know what you're thinking, but I thought there were four. Or maybe that's what you're thinking. You may be thinking something else, but I'm not going to try and guess beyond that. In many cases, there is a fourth movement. And what is the fourth movement? It's a dance movement of some sort. Most often, the minuet. Later, it became a scherzo. It could be other things. And what happens is the dance movement is inserted either right here or right here, either as the second or the third movement. That is, it's put in between the first movement and the second movement, or between the second and the third. In the classic era, most of the time it goes in as the third movement. I would say the vast majority of the time. It becomes more common in the Romantic era to put it there, although it's still probably more common there. So, it's an optional movement, though. It need not be there. How optional is it? Well, let me give you an example. Mozart, as you may know, did a lot of traveling, especially when he was a young man. And he would go from city to city and appear and play concerts, and you all very often with an orchestra, and he would write symphonies for these cities. That's why we have symphonies of Mozart. If you're familiar with them, one, there's a symphony called the Prague Symphony. There's a symphony called the Linz Symphony. That's because he wrote it for performance in that particular city. Now, there was a tradition in the 18th century with these orchestras that existed in different cities as to whether they would have a dance movement or not, that is, a minuet. In some cities, it was common to have a dance movement. In some, it was not. So if Mozart was in a city that where they normally had a dance movement, he would write a dance movement. If he wasn't there, he would not write a dance movement. Now, in Mozart's time, you know, we didn't have all of this quick, high-speed transmission of everything. So Mozart could very easily take his symphony that he wrote in Prague, carry it with him to Paris, where he would be next week, and who's going to know, right? Or not so much that, but who would have heard it? And so very often he would use the same, and I'm not picking on Mozart specifically, this was common when people traveled like this, musicians traveled, would be to often play the same pieces. Well, if he was in one city that it was traditional to have a three-movement symphony, then you'd have a three-movement symphony. If he'd go to the next city, he would simply write a minuet for that particular symphony and insert it in there. And it often worked in reverse. He would write a four-movement symphony, then he would go to another city, and he would simply take the minuet out and play it as a three-movement piece. Now, this happened over and over. So it's really an up-in-the-air thing. You can have it, and you may not. Another aspect, while I'm on this subject, and that is, until the 19th century, the idea of a symphony, any kind of piece, as an organic entity, as an organic whole, simply did not exist. It was more thought of as a collection of movements, and it would not at all be unusual, for instance, to take a symphony and break it up, to have two movements played earlier in the program, then have a bunch of other things which could be completely different, arias by singers or whatever it might be, and then later on play the last two movements. They simply did not think you needed to do all of this together. What's even more surprising, just to show how different a lot of attitudes and ideas were during this time, very often they would substitute a movement from one symphony for another, or put a movement from another symphony into whatever symphony was being played. This happened as late as Beethoven. The second movement of his Seventh Symphony was very, very popular. And so very frequently, when they would play one of his other symphonies, instead of playing the slow movement of that symphony, they would just play the slow movement of the Seventh Symphony because it was more popular. There was the idea of thinking of the piece as a whole didn't exist. Now, composers and musicians very much thought of individual movements as some sort of organized structure. So I'm not saying that the idea didn't exist, it's just that it didn't extend to the piece as a whole. That's one of the differences, and we'll talk about, between classic and romantic music. In the romantic period, and it really started with Beethoven, we begin to see composers thinking of the piece as a whole, as some sort of unit. But in the 18th century, not necessarily. Now, one more thing about movements. I was talking about how this is optional. There are certain genres which tended to have things more one way or the other. For instance, symphonies probably more often than not had the dance movement. String quartets usually had four movements. Most chamber music did. In the 18th century, the string quartet was by far the most important type of chamber music. In the 19th century, you begin to have other kinds that compete, such as the piano trio and others. The one place where you will just about never, ever hear a dance movement, in the classic era at least, is in the concerto. If you think about when you go to a concert and listen to concertos, there are almost always three movements. There are a few exceptions in the 19th century, but not many. It held throughout the 19th century. Now, the one genre that really gives us trouble with all of this is the sonata. Sonata, most of the time, was three movements. Beethoven, at first, tended to put a fourth movement in there, but sometimes it could be even less. Sometimes it could be two. It varied a good bit. There is no consistent pattern with the sonata. So when you go to a recital and someone's going to play a sonata, you can't be sure what to expect. You just have to kind of wait until you see the program and see what it is. So that's the way it works as far as different kinds of pieces, how they're at least structured in terms of movement structure. And from here on, what we'll be talking about after we get through some introductory stuff, talking about specifically about musical elements, we'll be talking about how individual movements are organized. In other words, what we're going to look at will be specific movements and say, how does a composer put this together? More from the point of view as a listener, what am I listening for? What am I anticipating? What am I expecting? And what happens?